Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's normally it gives me great pleasure to introduce speakers. But I suppose there must be an exception to everything. So, in introducing Basil McDermott, I want to say this is done with a certain amount of trepidation and a good amount of hesitation and a faint sense of horror, since I know roughly what he's going to talk about. But I always think of myself as a man who is able to avoid the notion that every argument was ad hominem, and that indeed you can separate out a person's ideas from who he is. And I would think that in terms of my continued relationships with Basil over the years, this is living testament to that proposition. Okay. Now, having said that, I'd just like to say another few words, which perhaps might explain my state of mind, and that is that those of you who know Basil well will know that he has worked very hard and assiduously over time, first of all in examining many of the really important issues that face man, such as his own survival. This is reflected in his teaching, and some years ago we sat down and I think we'd got three quarters of the way through a bottle of Chablis and chilled oysters, when it dawned on us that perhaps instead of having courses that merely reflected the state of the art now and what was yesterday, that is to say the historical approach to the understanding of ideas within a discipline, that there might be a notion about trying to anticipate that which is not yet. And the next thing that we had was a proposal from Basil for a course on alternative futures. This was examined with a mixture of amusement, hostility, and fear when it finally got to the Senate, but there was enough inertia, apathy, and stupidity in that gathering to allow the whole thing to go through. About 3 years after that course was passed, it suddenly occurred to some people down at the University of California at Berkeley that it might be a very good idea if they had within their sort of equivalent of our Behavioral Science Foundation something called the study of alternative futures. And lo and behold, it appeared. Naturally, to say we had retroactive approval of the academic aspects of our course as a result of that. And that's one aspect of it. But you can't really talk about alternative futures until you discuss actual pasts, and this may come into this discussion to some extent. Basil produced a manuscript at one stage of the game which had to do with a vision of malevolence, in which he argued quite persuasively that far too little attention has been paid to the active study and promotion of evil, and the notion that evil is merely a mirror reflection of good is a terrible injustice to evil. And much of the book is spent in examining the nature of people who engage in good works to obviously evil ends. And the intent is to show that with a little honesty and a little foresight, it would be proper to do to the concept of evil real justice. Needless to say, this met also with a variety of mixed reactions. There were some people who took them seriously. Okay, so here we are now, having come from the Colosseum to the Colloquium, Basil, and perhaps you can track that course for us.
Let me sit down first.
An author was once asked if his novels were ever based on actual persons and events rather than pure fiction. The questioner further suggested that authors in general are actually quite cowardly and extremely sneaky as well. They used fiction only, he said, to hide the fact that their actual writing was frequently based on real people and real events, including their absurdities. Fiction, according to the hostile questioner, was simply a very useful way, in case any given person was angered sufficiently enough by the unfair and harsh treatment of the author, to avoid three rather unpleasant possibilities. First, there was the possibility that the author may be challenged to a duel to the death, which, if he lost, would deprive him of his life. Secondly, there was the possibility of secret assassination, which once again would cut short a brilliant writing career. And thirdly, and much more seriously, was the threat of a lawsuit for libel, which might deprive the author of his book royalties. To these various charges, the author responded, "My good fellow, though my limitations are many, a lack of imagination is not among my major faults. I have as little trouble imagining human folly as the norm on this planet as most people have in imagining that they are in actual control of their own destinies, or they could be if they really wanted to work at it." Now, it seems to me the author's response is actually misleading. After all, nothing is more beguiling than for an author to make such disclaimers of intentional malevolence and libel. Thus, what you are about to hear does resemble persons now living, yet soon to be, in the cosmic scheme of things, quite dead. Furthermore, there is little that's coincidental or accidental about such resemblances. Therefore, in the words of Saint-Monty de Pisson, "Good evening. Welcome to Spot the Loony." I commence the reading of a paper by discharging a small, trivial, and insignificant intellectual debt, as behooves all serious scholars. This paper has profited considerably by not incorporating very many of the suggestions made to me by my friend and colleague, Dr. Robert J.C. Harper. An attempt to spread guilt and incompetency, however, necessitates a recognition that I must pay to his willingness to discuss the seriousness of academic arrogance in the modern world. He was furthermore especially enlightening about the true history of the footnote, which we shall come to later. There are some interesting connections between the ordeals, which were once a part of the life in the Colosseum under Rome, the ordeals practiced in the Middle Ages, and the special type of ordeal that the university colloquium, or seminar, represents in our own era. The connecting link is the steadfast obsession that humans have demonstrated with notions of guilt and innocence, truth and falsehood, competency and blundering, loyalty and disloyalty. Actually, it would be more apt to argue that humans have indicated a profound difficulty in living with one another on this planet without periodic resort to organized murder and persecution, to justify, at least in some limited way, these violent manifestations. Rationalizations have been developed around the justice and the necessity for such actions. An Aesop fable captures the gist of this curious process. A cat had caught a rooster and was looking for a plausible reason to eat him. First, he accused the rooster of being a nuisance to men because he crowed at night and wouldn't let them sleep. The rooster said that he did this for men's own good, for he was arousing them to go about their accustomed tasks on time. Again, the cat said, "But you are also a confirmed transgressor against nature in mating with your sisters and your mother." When the rooster also said that he did this for the good of men, also because he enabled them to have more eggs, The cat was nonplussed and said, "Am I to forego the pleasure of meeting you simply because you always have an excuse?" Very few of you roosters out there expect to be arrested by some legal cat, subjected to a modern ordeal to determine your guilt, and then devoured by the prosecuting attorney who also served as your judge. Your belief, however, that you're unlikely to be arrested in the near future is based almost entirely on your own limited personal experience, not on whether you might actually deserve to be arrested, though perhaps not roasted and eaten for your crimes. There are, in fact, simply too many laws in existence for you to avoid periodic violations. We are all, quite simply, like it or not, cohorts in crime. Though not all criminal activity is of equal importance for a society. Nevertheless, if you were to be held accountable for each offense against human life and property values that you have perpetrated simply while driving your car, you could end up serving time. And if your tax forms were to be audited with a vengeance, if your sexual behavior was exposed along with other assorted misdemeanors and felonies, then sure, you'd be up for life. But most of the time, you don't worry about such things taking place. However capable you are of demonstrating extreme nervousness whenever a cop walks or drives by. Awareness that we all have hidden criminal tendencies haunts our minds and leads to some curious thoughts. The universality of presumed immoral and illegal behavior even tempts some people to assume that the police would never, surely, arrest a person unless he was guilty. Why else would they do it? A friend of mine once asked with puzzled innocence. Why indeed? If the doctrine of universal guilt is actually true, then we should never evidence surprise at the knock in the night, with or without a search warrant. The point here is painfully simple. Try as we may, there is a presumption among many people that the individual who is arrested is actually guilty until proven innocent. Furthermore, even an accusation of guilt may be deemed sufficiently conclusive to render the collection of additional evidence as quite unnecessary. In fact, to question the integrity of the accuser may be indicative that you yourself have a hidden agenda of nefarious activities which also needs thorough investigation. A considerable amount of legal history revolves around the incomplete struggle to suggest that a person ought to be considered innocent until proven guilty, not the converse. One reason this struggle remains incomplete is that many people are strongly tempted to yield to the contrary position, namely, the suspicion that every person is guilty of undisclosed offenses. Furthermore, to come to the rescue of one accused of a crime may lead to retaliation by the state. The human race is a fearful and suspicious lot. We're an easy mark for those who wish to sell us on the idea that our ideals are crucial to our existence. Thus, it's not surprising that we are all in our own way, in search of the perfect ordeal. By this I mean that we are compulsively and mechanically, if not cybernetically, driven, so to speak, to devise constant tests to discover the guilt or innocence of others, with a keen desire, of course, that guilt will predominate our conclusions. But the history of the ordeal involves more than guilt or innocence. It encroaches upon our concepts of truth and falsehood. It even includes attempts to define competency, or, as it is so often put in realistic circles, to discover if a person really has what it takes to make it. Which is to say, whether the individual meets our personal and social expectations of what's important. The essential trick in all of this is to control what is called the burden of proof. The quest for the compliant ordeal is to assign the other person the burden of proving that he did not do the dastardly deed. Whoever can assign the burden of proof in any area of life has a marked advantage in controlling the results of the ordeal undertaken. And these ordeals have been quite diverse from a historical standpoint. If you can control the acceptable criteria to evaluate people and events, you're in a very strong position to specify your conclusions in advance of the ordeal itself. In language the academy favors, he who prepares the final examination can determine how many and who shall pass. All of this, of course, is part of the conventional wisdom. This is the point where all truly interesting and intelligent discussions commence. There's no need to deviate until later from this tradition. So let's return to our original question or issue. Suppose, against all odds, that you were in fact arrested. I doubt that most of you believe that you would be physically tortured in order to encourage you to confess your heinous crimes, whatever they may be. No one, as Monty Python's Flying Circus puts it, expects the Spanish Inquisition to visit him in his cell as he awaits formal trial. But such expectations should be considered quite fragile. They are surely a distortion of how many people were treated historically and how some people are treated today. From much further back than the days of the Colosseum, when animals fed in the flesh of those whose loyalties went beyond Rome, even through the incredible centuries of the Inquisition, to the mass murders of the 20th century by the most seemingly diverse sort of ideological blood brothers, there has been a legacy to the use of instruments of coercion to discern guilt from innocence, truth from falsehood, or more aptly, loyalty from presumed betrayal. The hallmark of all authority is the temptation to argue that he who is not for us is against us. The revolutionary caricature of this lapse in clarity is the doctrine that he who is not part of the solution is most of the problem. An addendum to this confusion is the gleeful acceptance of the doctrine of collective guilt exemplified by no less a sage than Pogo himself when he muttered those careless words, "I have seen the enemy, and he is us." Minds that cannot free themselves from such cliches easily become entranced with ordeals and tests of all sorts in life. One conclusion that I hesitantly entertain is that the Earth is actually in a very dismal spot in the universe, and successively distant from the protective guidance of external intelligence, sanity, and decency. Hence, it is our lot to endure one another betwixt bouts of periodic warfare. In such moments of cosmic suspicion, I think of our world as a grand zoo, a kind of extraterrestrial experiment in which humanity has been given a certain set of illusions to work with. The chief illusions, as far as I am able to tell, are the beliefs that we now know what we are doing with our lives, both personally and collectively, and that we are now in actual control of our own destinies, or could be, if we really wanted to, notwithstanding our low level of development as humans. In a word, it's the curse of believing in our own death, as if we created our lives on our own. We're so sensitive to potential slights. We're so resentful that others will not automatically and joyfully see how admirable we intend to be, no matter our inconsistencies, that we transform our demands for love into a need to punish. We find it immensely difficult to think in a curious manner about how things work in life whenever we're preoccupied with proving ourselves right and other people wrong. The byproduct of this egotism has been the production of considerable misery, pain, and suffering in our world. Ordeals and tests are a part of this process. Now I've turned to thinking about ordeals in general. Discussions that focus on human cruelty often incite a curious response in many individuals. Some people who consider themselves very civilized are both puzzled and outraged that other people in other places in history could have acted so despicably toward one another. Without raising the easily misunderstood doctrine of collective guilt, I should like to cut off the intellectual and emotional escape route we are tempted to take whenever we prematurely condemn the wickedness or weakness of other people. In this instance, the outrage that we express toward other people who have engaged in mutilating humans is frequently based on the assumption that we are more civilized. We comfort ourselves with the illusion that such things could not happen here. Our presumption is that in similar circumstances, we would act differently. Note here that my emphasis is in no way intended to justify torture on the basis that everyone might do it under the proper circumstances, but rather that one should take great care in making bold pronouncements about how he or she would act under such conditions. In my view, very few people understand and know themselves well enough to make such confident assertions about their presumed immunity from surrounding fears, pressure, and stress. All significant discussions about human learning commence with a recognition of human vulnerability to a host of distractions which constantly lead people to betray what are called their ideals. Put differently, action is never a simple expression of one's beliefs, as if ideas are clear and consistent controlling devices which transcend the surrounding conditions. When you're very hungry, when you have not slept for several days, when you're ill, when you're in physical pain, when you're angry, when you're depressed, when you are under the influence of a variety of different things, all of these aspects compete strenuously with whatever ideas, values, beliefs, attitudes you believe you possess and which you believe guide you through life. The interesting thing about the argument that circumstances influence and control responses, that our very willingness to believe and to do certain things in life ebbs and flows according to the state we are in, complicated by the conditions around us, is our resentment of the abstract idea that we are not in substantial control of our own destinies, as compared to the acceptance of specific examples in our life which do influence what we do, how we feel, and even what we believe. All of this has an important bearing on ordeals and torture. It's my way of switching the emphasis from your beliefs about whether you believe you would be tortured if arrested to your beliefs about the conditions under which you, yourself, would torture another person. Note carefully, I have not asked if or whether you would engage in such an activity, but rather I have inquired as to the circumstances, as best you can assess them now, under which you might torture another person. Those who are emotionally prepared to investigate such a question may wish to add clarity and precision to the major intent of the issue. Several additional refinements come to mind. What, for example, does one mean by torture? Are we speaking of physical torture, or mental, psychological, emotional torture, or some combination? To what extent or degree are we speaking about torture? how much pain must be inflicted? How permanent might the damage be? Does it make a difference to you which people may be involved, as distinct from how far, short of death, such tortures may be inflicted? What purposes, if any, do you believe would be sufficient to permit, if not encourage, you to use torture? On this last question, one may add that, like it or not, nearly everyone believes that at least some ends do justify an almost limitless variety of means to approach, if not attain, such goals. I do not view the prospects of torturing another person with a limited detachment, nor can I muster a convincing denial that I would ever engage in such an ordeal. Indeed, I can think of at least two circumstances, at least, under which I would inflict torture on another person to the point of death, although each of these situations raised considerable doubts in my own mind about how much confidence I should have that the torture itself would actually be effective in accomplishing the ends that I thought merited such atrocious behavior. And I use the word atrocious with deliberation, for I'm not speaking about actions that I take can be easily justified, whatever that may mean, let alone emulated. Nevertheless, I would torture another person if I was convinced that he or she had information which, if revealed, would save lives of other people about whom I cared and would lead to their deaths if concealed. In a second instance, I can also conceive of torturing an individual who has done me no real or imagined harm in order to prevent someone I care about from suffering a similar fate. I would quickly add that the second case seems more reprehensible than the former. There are two immediate reflections that jump to the forefront of my mind in this dismal discussion. In the first place, I have confessed that a willingness to act in a manner which is considered despicable by our standards is based on my personal belief that such action would be effective. Now, on what basis should I, or anybody else for that matter, have such confidence? To this burning question, I have no adequate, or for that matter, no hesitant answer. Secondly, I have not attempted to excuse such actions on the basis that I was simply following orders, since I have conceded a willingness to torture in situations where I was not being personally threatened, although in my second example, my identification with the person I cared about will make this distinction of decreasing importance. I assume, however, that the dynamics of fear would lead me to extend my range of situations to include increasing numbers of victims. If we could take the obedience experiments of Milgram as even mildly suggestive of a willingness of people to comply with instructions to harm another person for the sake of science, then the argument becomes even more sinister. For Milgram argues that even lacking the threat of personal bodily harm, or the threat of imprisonment, or the fear of losing one's job, that, given the proper conditions, a surprising amount of compliance can be obtained, which violates a person's beliefs about what he considers to be right or wrong. But let us take care here. To wander through the modern archives that constitute the conventional wisdom of the so-called behavioral and social sciences is to become seriously alarmed about the gaps in our awareness about the major factors which influence how we live and move and have our being. Obviously, my immediate temptation in answering the question about my willingness to torture another human is to protest vehemently. With Peter, we all take our illusory stand. Though all men may deny, we shall remain steadfast. In my own estimation, of who I think I am, I find myself unable to conceive that I would ever succumb to torturing another person. Rather than inflict harm, I would choose to die first. How touching a sentiment. In my fictitious construction of my own belief system, and how it presumably directs my daily activities, I become a mythical godlike figure that's immune from hunger, sleep, love, criticism, exercise, disease, fear. I stand apart from the needs of the body and become pure mind, intellect, and altruism. Such illusory views of myself and the multiple factors that really influence how I am likely to behave in differing circumstances are not on speaking terms with one another. Only those who recognize their weaknesses can take proper precautions against their misuse. Only those who understand the vastness of their potential failures are likely to learn how to smile secretly to the cosmic zookeepers. But I digress. We are now ready to reflect on some curious aspects of historic ordeals. I previously indicated that perhaps one reason we have difficulty in thinking clearly about such matters is our lack of personal experience. A more appealing reason, however, for our puzzlement over patterns of deliberate cruelty, such as various kinds of ordeals represented, is the crudeness of the assumptions involved. After all, on the surface at least, we are asked to believe that distinctions between guilt and innocence, truth and falsehood, are aptly revealed by increasing physical pain in diversely imaginative ways. Is this not methodology gone awry? What offends the modern spirit of inquiry is not necessarily moral niceties about inflicting harm on helpless victims, but the epistemological assumptions upon which such experiments were based. Everyone knows that it's much easier to rub red pepper in the eyes of some poor devil in order to encourage a confession than to round up additional evidence in the hot sun. No, the major objection to torture is that the evidence obtained is highly unreliable. In modern parlance, it's very sloppy methodology. The most taciturn of men become voluble under the proper circumstances. The catch, of course, is that the ancients were perfectly aware of these dangers. They knew they had an imperfect methodology, and this was one reason why confessions extracted under torture needed reaffirmation in less punitive surroundings. But alas, this posed additional dilemmas, as in the case of one Dr. Bobazan in 1514, who, when told that he may retract his earlier confession, coaxed from him under torture, said to the agents of that part of the cosmic zoo, "During my examination, I was at one time stretched upon the rack for 6 hours, and at another time, I was slowly burned for 8 hours. If I retract, I shall be exposed to these torments again and again. I had rather die." They hanged old Dr. Bobazan, methodological reservations to the side. Torture and ordeals make more sense if we keep several things in mind. If you lived in an age when it was much more usual to assume that an accused person was actually guilty, or knew who was, and that the burden of proof was upon the accused to establish his innocence, then ordeals and torture must be seen in a different light. They are not tools of impartial discovery, but methods designed to confirm previously determined conclusions. In a word, they were one part of the control systems that operated in the zoo at that time in history. The ordeal was useful as a special kind of punishment in those cases where the presumption of guilt was quite strong, yet conclusive proof was lacking. The fact that ordeals were of various types and could be controlled quite carefully by those who carried them out according to their sympathies or interests supports the idea that such adventures could serve multiple purposes in society. Both the threat of the ordeal and its undertaking undoubtedly loosened many a stubborn tongue quite in advance of the proceedings. An interest in rather immediate punishment pushes the search for truth into the background very quickly. I suppose that they too were a rather impatient lot and found it more efficient to combine the collection of evidence with the distribution of punishment on the spot rather than devise alternative methods to seek out truth. The transformation undergone by hapless clients of the torturer's art is captured in Professor Henry Lee's historical anecdote about, quote, the case of the unfortunate peasant sentenced for witchcraft who, in his dying confession to the priest, admitted that he was a sorcerer and humbly welcomed death as the fitting retribution for the enormous crimes of which he had been found guilty, but pitifully inquired of the shuddering confessor whether one could not be a sorcerer without knowing it. Ordeals were not officially considered as torture. Rather, they were tests. But tests, of course, can always be designed to bring the proper answers to the surface. Let me give a brief summary of the four seemingly major ones with appropriate irreverent comments. First, there was the ordeal of boiling water. A cauldron of water is heated to the boiling point. A small stone or a ring is thrown into the swirling water, in some cases, and the accused was then obliged to find the object with his bare hand, although sometimes his hand was covered with varying substances in advance, and presumably then with varying degrees of protection. In other instances, the testee was simply directed to plunge his hand into the water up to his wrist, which was called the single ordeal, say for trivial cases, or perhaps up to his elbow, called the triple ordeal, for gross crimes. The submerged parts were then wrapped for 3 days, after which careful to casual inspection would reveal the degree of guilt. The innocent, presumably, were relatively unaffected, the theory maintained. Then there was the ordeal by red-hot iron. There were two forms of this heated examination process. One consisted in laying down upon the ground in different patterns and in differing distances plowshares that had been heated. And then one must walk either blindfolded, without one's shoes, or without a blindfold, and to touch one's foot against the heated objects. In a second variation, it consisted of carrying on one's arms a red-hot iron a particular distance. In each instance, the members were wrapped and examined 3 days later according to the same aspects of the ordeal by boiling water, namely that innocent renders one burn-proof. Then there was the ordeal by direct fire. Pyromancy, as every eager student of the future realizes, is a fondness for predicting the future through a detailed analysis of flames. The ordeal by direct fire was conducted in different ways, each with a predictive aim in mind. One variation on this pyric theme was a simple hand or arm thrust into a fire for a varying degree of time. Another aspect involved a fire walk through flames of specified height and presumably temperature. In this ordeal, as in all others, it's important to understand that those who built the fire, supplied the wood, dictated what could and could not be worn
specified how quickly one must stride through the flames, and interpreted the degree of singe, which would be minimally acceptable to ascertain innocence, could often obtain the desired results. Then finally there was the ordeal of cold water. Of the major examinations concocted to test the truth of things, this one is the most interesting, perhaps, because it changed the normal burden of proof. In the previous ordeals, a presumed miracle was needed in order to establish innocence. In this instance, it took a miracle to convict rather than to acquit. A person was bound and lowered into a pool of water that had been appropriately exorcised. Sometimes a rope was attached to the individual to make sure that successful clients could be pulled from the depths after proving their innocence by sinking. The reasoning was quite delicious. The virtuous pool of water, through its very purity, was incapable of permitting entry of the guilty. Like the human body and its immunity processes, it would reject foreign and hostile elements, hopefully. One wonders, however, how long submersion was necessary before innocence was concluded. For at that point, of course, the bound testee would need quick extraction from the water, lest success lead to quick failure through drowning. Once you understand that torture and ordeals are humble methods of social control, your methodological resentments can relax somewhat. It also suggests that we take care not to dismiss the ancients as simply superstitious about such matters. For the Colosseum and later ordeals also had something to do with human emptiness, as well as with grandeur and oppression. And those who have become addicted to the creation and maintenance of ordeals throughout history should not be seen as simple-minded sadists, but a rather motley group of true believers and fearful, if not eager, followers. Their distribution of human suffering even seems paltry and embarrassingly inadequate according to contemporary capacities. To be assigned to the dark planet Earth with its very primitive knowledge system is to be endowed with an ability to learn how dangerous the world is, but with no adequate blueprint for cosmic alterations. If, in the idealistic sense, there are different levels and types of cosmic ordeals, which might lead us to a closer appreciation of what is truly important in life, then we might keep this in mind as we wander around the cosmic zoo. The quest for the perfect ordeal, then, becomes a metaphor for a search for alternative knowledge systems which might put the zookeepers out of business. We now turn to ordeal by footnote. Cicero was rumored to have wondered how two soothsayers from alternative schools of prophecy could, upon meeting one another in broad daylight, refrain from uproarious laughter. He was puzzled, one guesses, that it seemed so insufficient to their own sense of importance that they could not be satisfied with their admirable ability to relieve gullible citizens of their money with very mundane predictions. But money and fame were not enough. Each soothsayer yearned for respectability, and each dreamed of controlling vast institutions of higher learning so that the proper study of the future could be undertaken according to sound predictive techniques. To a soothsayer, the future is no laughing matter. And thus it's easy to imagine the quality of intellectual discourse between, say, a necromancer who considered himself an expert in prediction through communications with the dead, and an Etruscan diviner who specialized in the prophetic potency chicken livers. Necromancy. It isn't true that dead men tell no tales. I hear voices all the time.
but it's not easy to interpret what they mean. It takes a lot of training and a lot of expensive equipment. How much time have you ever spent in the cemetery with a stethoscope? But you know, we've come on hard times. The government refuses to give us enough money
so we can really find out what's going to happen to us in the future. You know, without proper research funding, the Roman Empire could start declining. Liverman. You're a loony. All your voices are methodologically unsound. They lack rigor, sir, rigor. You've got no social context for your experiment. You don't even have any footnotes. Now, we refer to footnote number 10. Here. As the world of scholarship has long come to recognize, Liverman's empirical research now dominates human consciousness. Not only did his efforts give rise to modern French cuisine, he himself abandoned chicken livers for geese livers in Le Montfauché later in his career. But, little known to many academics, Liverman invented a footnote upon which so much scholarly thievery depends. As a diversion to his detailed drawings of the innards of various birds and beasts, he became fascinated with feet. As chickens were his specialty during those arduous years when he was preparing for his rigorous Latin liver examinations, he developed a theory concerning the reliability of any given chicken liver to reveal accurately what the future held. In short, he argued that no chicken liver that had not traveled extensively could ever possess a properly educated liver. Hence, an analysis of chicken feet was mandatory to indicate how much and where the chicken had traveled. He would then, in true scholarly fashion, unlike the necromancers of his own era, note the feet of various chickens whenever he addressed learned bodies. Through time, a reference to chicken feet was simplified into the common footnote. It is one of the tragedies of modern education that so few students are acquainted with the genuine history of the footnote.
You don't even have any footnotes. You're never going to find out about the future unless you get inside of things.
I used to be into hearts, lungs, and gizzards myself. But once old Julie opened up Gaul on the western frontier, I took a PhD in liver analysis. Now, let me tell you, that was a rigorous course of study. Not only did we learn how to predict wars, famines, and plagues, but we also became proficient in making pâtés out of the livers. So as well as having superior academic credentials to serve the empire, I also have a practical trade. And I'm not at all like you airy-fairy necromancers or those necrophiliacs.